Welcome to Teo Podcast, The Pandemic Press. I am your host, Rashni Evavasam, and today we have a special guest named Lou Ford, and he's going to talk about the international drug policy.
Yes. Thank you again for having me. I appreciate it. Real looking forward to this. My name is Lou Ford. I am a writer, freelance journalist, podcaster. Right now, I currently am the host of the podcast Coffee and a Car Ride. It's basically a podcast where it's discussions of current issues, either it's rants or sometimes me, you know, having conversations or interviews with other guests. And issues also, as we're discussing here right now, drug policies, issues along, addiction, those kind of topics, and other issues of the day that are kind of important, whether it be COVID-19, whether it be voter rights, but more recently we've been touching a lot more on drug policies and like the opioid epidemic, which has been going on in the U.S.
Can you please explain what the global drug policy is?
Global drug policy is basically policies that kind of govern how the legalization, the criminalization, the enforcement of laws dealing with substances, whatever those substances may be, the heroin, cocaine, the import, the production, the legal penalties that go along with possession, use, the sale, all those policies that come in terms of dealing with those things internationally, because obviously in terms of when you're talking about drugs and the drug trade, it is an international basically business that deals in a lot of facets, whether it be legal through prescription pharmaceuticals, or whether it be illegal through drug cartels, smuggling, drug sales, many aspects. Money laundering is a whole facet.
So what
policies?
Yes. So which country do you think has the best drug policy?
I'd have to say, I think it's a tie between a couple, Belgium, Germany, Netherlands, and I think Canada to a degree. Many of those nations have kind of gone from more or less just straight up punishment and have gone to more the idea of it's not the addict's fault. And so they found ways of kind of decriminalizing or having harm prevention built into the system, so it doesn't turn something that could potentially be turned around and made good out of into something worse. If you're sending someone who is a user into the prison system, it's not as likely that that person will necessarily, not always, it depends also on the justice system, but
we lost you.
They will learn how to continue their criminal activity, or also even if they try, as in with the U.S., the laws are built in to kind of really prevent there being the ability for a convicted, especially if you're a felon, a convicted felon, from really being able to kind of rise up or move away from, from those convictions. So even if you've had years of being, legal, behaving legally, no use, nothing that in any way would put you in a detriment, that mark on your record will prevent you from, in some cases, depending on where you live, states, from being able to vote, being able to participate in local governments, being able to get certain jobs. So you may have skills and all that could help you, in your community, or help you to help your community. And because of those, in many cases, drug felonies, you could be prevented from being able to do that. And that only furthers to drive people to thereby either go back to using or continue doing other activities that got them locked up in the first place.
Yeah. So,
in places like, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So I also wanted to tell you, what do you think the problem is for people to go after drugs?
What do I think the problem is? It's a tough question, but I think that's both an easy and a tough question to answer. I think it's easy because it's obvious, because there are many drugs that can be incredibly harmful, even when regulated. You look at the opioids, fentanyl, Oxycontin, things like that. And in the U.S., they were heavily regulated, and up until very recently, and even though it's still going on now, you had the opioid epidemic, where you had a company that came in and it developed a new product and marketed it irresponsibly, pushed it. They made it appear as though that the drug was not that addictive, and the drug was supposed to be getting regulated, and it turned into, and it ballooned and it exploded into a huge deck. And, it was also showed how the marketing could be used, and it targeted certain demographics, in terms of this time with the legal, in terms of going after working class people with what was considered to be chronic pain. The point is that on both sides, drugs are good and drugs are bad. And, you can look at it as that, and you can say that in terms like the opioid epidemic, opioids are great. They can deal with pain. They can help someone who is in pain. They can help somebody who, has cancer, is going through an operation, is going through a procedure. But at the same time, if not regulated correctly, if not handled honestly, if marketed just for the purpose of greed, will result in addiction, death, criminality in some cases, loss of life. If you look at, up until recently, U.S., cannabis, is now becoming more legal, but even, then there's been a question of it, as to its effects, in terms of some of the unregulations. So I think people go after it because they can see the harm. I also think there's money involved. I think, there's a lot of political, there's politics that are involved as well. I think we forget in it the people who are the victims, the people who are the addicts, the families, those who are, affected by it as well. I think overall, I don't think it's an easy question to answer, because the reality is that as shown, people want it, they're going to go after it. And, and so I think it's there has to be some middle ground. I don't know. In the U.S. recently, like in Oregon, they basically decriminalized small amounts of almost all substances, including like amphetamines, meth, coke, heroin. Possibly a good right way to go. But I think people go after it because they see the harm it can do. I think they go after it because, to a degree, if it's illegal, you can make more money from it.
What I think is that people are looking for a temporary getaway, if you know what that means. Mm-hmm. And but they have no idea how to use the drug or which kind of dosage. They don't know all these kind of mechanisms, once they get addicted to it, there's no control over their health, over health conditions, and there's nobody to monitor, especially when you don't read or ask someone of an expert about this drug. You kind of don't know where you're going with it. You just have this tool that gives you a temporary getaway. And how can the country educate these individuals that it starts that they're actually going after a temporary getaway, not a permanent it doesn't give them permanent happiness.
Oh, that's a very good question. I guess this is also a tough one. I my opinion, so you have to understand, I'm also a recovering addict. And one of the reasons why this field has, just saying this is background as well, reason why this aspect, this topic, has been of interest to me is because I'm also married to someone who has worked in the drug and alcohol treatment field, as well as, like in the courts legally for a while. So she's had a great deal of experience in terms of like the other side of the field, in terms of like treatment, all the different aspects of it. I know that, I'm an addict. I use heroin. So, my whole deal, I understand. It's very hard. I think part of it is, and this is again a good and plus and minus, is that, at least from my perspective, is that the idea of how helpful drugs can be is kind of built into our society. When you talk about to a degree, like with alcohol, it's a way of relaxing, so there is this idea of what is drinking responsibly, but everywhere you go and you look, you do see, and it's good and bad, this idea that drugs can solve the problem. You look at ads on TV, drugs can solve the problem. And so I think education is important. I think it's important to note that that there isn't anything wrong to a degree with sometimes people experimenting. It actually can be helpful. But I think education is important. It's just, it's hard to find the right education to do.
It's so hard to understand, especially some complex phenomenon. So I would say is that people like addicts should be given some goals, that you should have, so they won't be so dependent on these products. And then they should go within themselves. What is causing their trauma? What is causing them to actually take in these temporary artificial products just so you can get the temporary high off? And when you go back to trauma, you go deeper and deeper into the past and you find out what went wrong. Forgive everybody that betrayed you. Like what I did was like, I befriended my bullies. I was really picked on. I was picked on from an early age, and what this culture we are living in has, I think, has implemented some wrong foundations. Like we have race theory, and to be honest, if you consider science, it's more about human race. We are supposed to be helping everybody of every color, everybody of every origin. And when you talk about drugs, it's supposed to, there are plant medicines and there are artificial drugs. Some drugs can help you, and to which degree you need an expert for the artificial ones. And that's if you're dealing with an immensely harmful condition. And you have plant medicine that you should know how to use it, because some sections give the high off and some sections give the healing. And these kind of theories haven't been taught to us. So we have embedded all these kind of, it's incorrect, but we have kind of embedded all these beliefs while we were growing up. And that's how I think all of this started.
I do. I have to agree on many aspects of that. I do think it is. The one thing I think is hard, and it's going to take a very long time to change, it's just that I'll say at least in the U.S., in the U.S. And this is, you know, this is, you know, this is my critique. Doesn't mean it's correct or whatever. And I think, you know, again, things have changed a lot. So let's be real. But I do think in many instances, with a lot of U.S. politics, it is racist is connected. And I think I think in general, the culture has for a very long time kind of been in one way or another, the idea that substances are projected. I mean, if you really want to look at it, the reason why the Mayflower landed where the Mayflower landed was because they were running out of beer. They were supposed to go to the Hudson. Instead, they didn't make it to the Hudson because the pilgrims didn't have enough beer on the ship. And so they had to land somewhere before the sailors were going to get upset. You know, substances, I think, in terms of mankind, have been around for a long time. It's there needs to be some type, you know, like you said, of education. We need to learn that. I think in terms of what I've seen in terms of the U.S., in terms of how substances have been injected, it's very, what is this? It's very embedded in our society. It's very stereotypical as well. So some things are looked at as being more one way than another way. So cocaine is looked at as being this way. This, you know, opioids are looked at as being this way. It's very, it's already very kind of prejudiced.
Yeah.
Confusing. It's prejudiced. We have, again, like in our society, you know, it's part of the other problem also is that there still is the idea that, and not that the addict shouldn't be held responsible, but there is the shame that comes along with the addiction. And with that shame, kind of, it makes it harder to be able to, for somebody who is an addict, to be able to kind of come look for the help, seek the help, be able to come and try to get it. When you also have and I know other systems do it too, where, you know, other countries do it too. You have many other nations, you know, Singapore, whatever, you know, India, whatever, all different places, as well as the U.S., that really criminalize drug use and drug, you know, and drugs. And right or wrong, it's been a proven fact, I think, that when you make it more and more and more bad, people are still going to seek it out. It just means that they're going to go further and further underground to get it.
Yeah.
And I think,
I think that they should actually have a willingness to change. Without that, they won't change.
that's why I think, like, if you look at nations like, was it Portugal? Yeah, I think I said Portugal. Portugal did that where they really kind of just almost decriminalized almost everything. I don't think that, if I'm correct, don't quote me on this, I don't think they made it legal, but they basically decriminalized it. So it was something that was still, like, you could get in trouble for it, but it wasn't that big. And they focused a lot more on the idea of saying, okay, let's offer, like, the help. You have things like in Canada, you know, you have things like in, like, the city of Toronto or whatever the case may be, where there are places where you can go to inject legally under supervision, and they keep an eye on you to make sure that you don't end up overdosing. There are, you know, other programs, other nations where they have something where it's like, okay, the addicts can't get sober, then they come to these places, but we also offer job training. We also offer all these things. We have addiction professionals there. And so every time they come, we can offer them a service. We can say, hey, if you want to get clean, if you want to move on, you want to try something else, you can do that. If not, you're still here. We're not going to prevent you. We're not going to tell you that you're wrong for doing what you're doing, but, you know, we're offering the support, but we're also offering you a job. You know, like, we're offering you all these different things. Many of those nations have found that to be much more effective at kind of really being able to change the idea of how substances are seen. The one thing I haven't, the research I'd done, this was like years ago. I know that one point with, like, the Netherlands, when they had the idea of legalization of pot, the hard drugs were still illegal, and they did find that those drugs were just being, you know, smuggled in and sold. So I think it's a question of, what are you going to legalize? How are you going to do it? And how are you going to educate it? And how are you going to make it clear that there are consequences, but also not demonize it to the point that, you know, that it is going to really cause a cultural, you know, social, economic issue that is also going to, you know, put you in a category that's going to lead to consequences that may ultimately take away your ability to move on from your addiction. Again, substances can be helpful. Right now they're finding that magic mushrooms, shrooms, those kind of, psychedelics are very helpful with dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, are very helpful with dealing with the trauma, like you talked about, in terms of being able to, deal with those things in the past.
But it's not impossible to do it yourself either.
But yeah, no, I'm not saying it's not impossible. What I'm saying is that if you're going to, one way to kind of help to incorporate that, if you're talking about the uses and finding good, helpful ways, is that there are promising aspects of some of these things.
But they have to know their correct dosage.
You just don't do it yourself. You just don't go and say, hey, I'm going to do this and I'm going to go, I'm going to go hang out in the woods and, hope for the best. Let me see if I can sort out my trauma, and get lost for about 6 days or whatever and not know where you are, but at the same time, there is some use. The problem is, again, my perception is that I find that too much comes down on the addict and the people who are on the lower level and the people who, as you could look at in terms of like this opioid epidemic with, with all the companies that did what they did, they're not really facing any charges. The people who own those companies, people who own those pharmaceutical companies aren't facing those. They call, people who really make money from, in some cases from drugs, don't face the consequences that somebody who's on the street or a daily user or somebody who, gets caught smuggling something faces. You're going to have even an equal playing ground. I think that also needs to be made clear that, there's a lot that can be done.
The thing is that crime like this should be actually treated as a mental health issue. You can't put them in a jail and make them suffer.
Exactly. Yeah.
So can you compare the drug policies between like certain countries?
I'm trying to think here. Yeah. I mean, I can, I do. I think I can. Like I said, when you talk about Portugal or you talk about like Germany to a degree, they focus a lot more of the harder enforcement on the idea of the smuggling, on the idea of like the, like the manufacturing of it, of the larger scale kind of stuff in terms of, again, the addicts and all that. It's not that like you commit a violent crime and you're an addict. You got to go to jail. You have to. It doesn't mean you can't get treatment in jail. It doesn't mean we can't correct the justice system, the jails, whatever. That's a huge thing that needs to be done, which is attached to this, but they focused more on the idea of it being brought in, the idea of who's bringing it in, who's making the money, who's kind of facilitating this. The U.S., they've started to do that, but at the same time, not so much. Have majority of our jail in many countries, majority of the jails sometimes are filled up with the addicts, with the small time people, with the people who, right or wrong, don't necessarily deserve to be there. You have people who've been caught with small amounts of drugs, and because, like, let's say the 80s during the crack epidemic, small amount of crack, you get more time, while the same amount with regular powder cocaine, not so much. There is a race thing connected too. People, the exact statistics I don't have in front of me, but I know that there's just as many white people that get in trouble for drug crimes as well, but they don't get locked up as high rates as people who are minorities. You all want to look at some of the problems as well. Look at, in terms of the United States, the indigenous population and the Native Americans suffer greatly. They don't get much support. I think you need to kind of look at, again, changing it as a whole society, as addiction not being this horrible, terrible, shameful thing, is something that for the most part is a disease and something that is a mental health issue. We need to kind of find a way to prop up our healthcare, prop up the mental health system so that way we can deal with this, offer fair consequences, but consequences that make sense and consequences that overall, unless of course the offender is proven to be like violent or any along those lines, is going to be helpful.
So do you think the law has something to do with it compared to the USA and Europe?
I think so. I mean, when you say law, do you mean I mean, do you mean more like law enforcement? Do you mean more like justice system?
Yes. Kind of,
yeah, I do. I think as with a lot of stuff, I think it's very cultural. You know, I think it's you know, I think it has to do with what's been implemented in the U.S. In reality, there is a lot of money to be made from prisons. And the more you can lock up, the more you can make it easier to keep people coming back, the more money's made. Again, it's a stereotypical thing in terms of drug use and, you know, the culture. You know, it's, you know, again, having being looked down upon, you know, just in general, it's just, it's something that is, I think the view that everybody has in general all the way around needs to change. How law enforcement sees addicts and users and dealers, and how the public sees them, how addicts see law enforcement, how addicts see the idea of penalties, the idea of, you know, of all treatment, all that. I think all those things need to change. It needs to be, I think, a drastic shift. The most promising thing I've seen, and I'm not saying I 100% agree with it, has been to a degree decriminalization and possible legalization. I think that that has at least changed the playing field to a degree. It is off again, but then I also think it's offered a whole bunch of new, you know, problems as well too. I mean, what's your take on that?
So I think that the law, does it have a proper consequence in Europe? I learned that there are proper consequences for each aspect of the law. It depends on, it depends on which ground. Once the judge finds you guilty, there is a consequence for your actions. But it's not all the time that happens in the US.
That's basically, I mean, from my understanding in my research too. I mean, I think, I think there are certain countries that have kind of shown their understanding, you know, kind of the need to kind of change the perspective. And, you know, I mean, I'll ask you this. Do you think that looking at some more extreme bans are useful or helpful? I mean, like if you look at some nations that have kind of said, you know, zero tolerance, we're not going to do it, you know, it's not happening. Do you find that they have, do you think that there's been any success in their kind of like hard-nosed policies towards like drugs?
Yeah, I don't know about the European policies, but I do know that the law, it has a consequence. I mean, they take stern actions to those who they find guilty, and they have a more controlled system than US. And that's what I thought of what's happening with the people, because the people have more direction here. Here, they're just lazy. That's the only thing that's wrong.
I got you. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also think that in the USA, they're always trying to find an answer, and they think the drugs and plant medicine are the answer for every medical issue. When the medical field is very expensive.
Yeah.
Healthcare is really expensive as well.
Yeah. No, it's healthcare. Yeah. That's, I think that's a huge, I mean, I think that's a huge, you know, aspect, you know, is the idea that at least for the US, I think Europe has gotten a better handle on it, is healthcare. In the US, it still is incredibly, you know, kind of, if you don't have a good job, if you don't have a union job, you don't have something that offers benefits, if you don't have the money to pay for it, in many instances, you're not going to get the best care. It depends on what it is, you know, and in terms of like drug treatment, in terms of anything at all that goes along those lines, if you don't have good insurance, you're not going to get good treatment. So it's not something that you're really going to be able to, you know, to afford, to pay for, to deal with in any capacity that's going to, you know, be helpful. And yeah, it's just, I agree wholeheartedly.
I also noticed that in Europe, it just depends on whether you can pay for the medical facilities. I don't think that just because you have a low-ranking job, You still get paid as equivalent, like you receive a equivalent healthcare as the others in Europe, but not in the USA. It's not the same. Everybody says the healthcare system is trash, and Canada, the Canadians do it better.
I've heard I've heard overall I've heard Canada does it better. I've heard some, a little bit of backlash to that depending on what it is. But again, I think overall, regardless of how well they do, the US is in a massive need for a healthcare reform. And I think if you're going to tackle a problem in any way like this, you need better healthcare.
Oh, and what have the Commission of Narcotic Drugs have done about this situation?
Ah, see. That's actually good. That's a good question there. Let's see. I mean, I had to check up on that again. That's my fault. But I've looked at a lot more of like more recently the US policies, and I've compared it, again to I let me just say this. First off, I think the big thing is that at least with the US is the US, I my opinion doesn't really, how can I put this? This is just a US attitude that has been developed and as that the US views themselves separately. So even though they're part of the UN, they don't really de they kind of it seems almost kind of it's kind of like I know better than you.
Oh,
And
standards are depressing. We've been told from a really young age that the US people act like the salad full of dressing.
That is basically the one thing that I found is very interesting is that while many aspects of kind of like of reform have tried to be done, a lot of times the US just kind of like swats it away. It's just kind of like, okay, whatever. Again, you look at Canada, you kind of see where it's kind of like started to fall in line, kind of like with the idea of like a more national kind of like, commission on drugs. I think they've had the right idea of kind of talking about the idea of treatment, of kind of like changing that up. And I think again, many nations like Germany, like Portugal, many nations like that have kind of taken that lead and have kind of said, it works better this way. I think again, if I think in terms of globally, if you're in order to really succeed in this way, you're going to need to have some sort of kind of unity behind how you deal with it. Because if you have some areas that aren't necessarily going to abide, it makes it difficult to kind of, to a degree, kind of solve the problem. It's just it. So I think, again, I think we, as I've stated before, I can't state enough, healthcare, mental health, I think need to kind of be put at the forefront. I think it needs to be something that's focused on a lot more. If we're ultimately going to be able to deal with this issue.
And how responsive is drug use in changes in price, risk of availability, and normalcy?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. That's the availability and all that. One thing that's very true, and that is X will change, but at the same time, if it's something that they do, I guess, kind of need or want, they'll find a way to get it. Most poignant thing I can point to right now where that kind of happened was basically how the opioid epidemic ballooned. And that was basically more or less due to the fact that what started off with pills eventually, because at some point the government did kind of kick in, healthcare systems did kind of kick in, doctors, hospitals who are catching, like way too much flack from the media, from from many sources would cut off the supply of pills, and heroin that was already around was available, and so addicts began going to heroin instead. they will switch. There will be something around. I think one thing that's very true is that as time goes on, people will find more potent forms of the substances that they want. And as a result, that to a degree will make it easier. You know, you have fentanyl. You know, when fentanyl was first really around, it wasn't really used that much. I mean, it was, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't on the scale that it is now. And I think the idea that because fentanyl was potent, you didn't need as much to smuggle, it was available, you know, many aspects made it much more for an addict, you know, kind of, as well as a dealer, appetizing. So I think, you know, there will be, you know, fluctuations. People will find a way to get it in, but people will find, you know, other forms and other capacities to kind of switch. Somebody's always going to find some way.
What about during this time, the pandemic?
Pandemic in the U.S., overdoses went up. Usage went up. It basically, even though many jobs were kind of closed and all that, because people, again, mental health, were alone, were worried, were scared, they were using more. And because things weren't available, friends, people weren't around to watch them. If people overdosed, they died. Depression, you know, it got worse. There were more overdoses during the pandemic than any other time, for the most part, during the opioid epidemic, because there was just no regulation. Nobody was around. You know, in some cases, emergency services weren't as readily available.
That you just think and find alternative positions, like alternative, like methods, like Zoom, for example, meetings, like not to drown in that drown in the ocean of fear, anxiety, doubt, sadness, trauma.
Yeah, I mean, people did, but at the same time, I guess they didn't. I mean, you could say the amount of fear, I think, that people felt to a degree, really it was overtaking. You know, I mean, there was many times where you had, you know, Zoom meetings, you had things like that. I mean, for instance, we don't talk about a 12 step or like recovery, you know, they had tons and tons of, you know, Zoom meetings for 12 step and for recovery, but it wasn't the same. So many people stopped going, because being there in person was different than being home alone, you know, where you could only be there for an hour. And then afterwards, you know, everyone would hang up and then you'd be alone in your house again.
Yeah.
So when before you could go to a meeting, you could
hang out there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You could go, you could hang out there. If you didn't feel safe, there were people there you could go get coffee with afterwards. You know, you could do things like that. With the Zoom meetings, it wasn't the same. Many people just dropped off. And then next thing you know, they were using again. There's something to be said about in-person interaction, and to a degree, you know, Zoom was great, but also at the same time, Zoom, I think, you know, after a while, was just kind of like, it just wasn't as easy. You know, it wasn't something that was easy. You know, it wasn't, you couldn't get the help that I think that many people felt that they needed, as opposed to being in person with someone.
Yeah, because they need to have the responsibility to carry out those steps, and that did not take place during that time.
There's many things. I also think it's important, you know, to note that, and if you're new, if you dealing with trauma yourself in terms of the pandemic, you know, lost your job, many of those aspects, you know, it's not, you know, when you have to be alone, you know, it just doesn't make it that easy. It's the mental health piece when it's kind of as it was, having to stay inside, having to stay away, you know, it just didn't make it easy. So, I mean, many people who were great or responsible, but when they had to really be able to deal on a regular basis all the time alone by themselves, you know, it's like anything else. You know, I think it's like solitary confinement. You throw somebody in solitary confinement, you know, they may eventually go insane, regardless of how responsible or how responsible or how sane they may appear to be. You know, it's something where there is a need for human interaction, and the help that was once available, if it's not there, you know, for many people with stress who are dealing with traumas of loss of, you know, somebody who may have, they may themselves have gotten sick. And then on top of that, you don't have like emergency services available because the hospitals are overwhelmed or, you know, or, you know, any number of things. I think it was just a whole culmination that was just kind of, you know, put together. You know, I think it was also an example of how the healthcare system was not prepared, you know, for a crisis. So,
and, yeah. So how can we stop the large numbers of drug involved in criminal offenders from using these sort of illicit drugs?
Oh, that's another very good question. There's a different, I think there's a couple of different angles you could take. You could go with that. One, there is like the possibility again of, like I said, of decriminalization. Which could mean that, you know, substance would not be, would, doesn't mean that the substance is legal, but it means that you're not going to be going to jail for it. So if you get caught with some pills, instead of it being something where you're going to get locked up, it would be like, okay, a citation, here's a ticket, you're going to pay a fine. You have some community service to do. You have something like that to do. Offering good treatment, fair treatment, something that, you know, something that is available to everyone, that's not going to cost them an arm and a leg, that they're not going to have to, you know, have to go talk to their insurance providers to, you know, to seek out a place that they're at that actually is going to get paid for. I think you need to invest more in terms of just jobs, education, into the idea of mental health, into the idea of addiction treatment. We need to also identify the fact that with addiction being a disease, that you don't deal with the disease with a jail. And that if you do those kind of things, that helps treatment. Our state, education. I think that is a tricky one because I think it's been tried several times. You have like in the US, you had like the DARE program that didn't really do anything, you know, that really didn't help. I think it's a very tricky kind of thing in order to find a way to educate someone about a substance or something like that, but not at the same time either one, make it more likely that they're going to use it, or two, stigmatize it. You know, I just think the overall policy and overall how we look at it has to be different. I think we need to change how we criminalize it. It's basically changing the culture. It's basically the idea of switching it up. It's people need to be held accountable, but at the same time, if you don't offer job training, if you don't offer opportunities to people to be able to find a way to have a better life or be able to have something like that, it's not as easy. You know, if you don't have the opportunities available to you, you know, you can try to make them, but you know, if there's something that's more available, there's job training available to you. If there's, you know, there's more, you know, whatever there is, if there's more option, you know, more options, more things, if you don't have to worry about student debt, you don't have to worry about things like that, then there's probably a more likelihood that people will try to get better jobs, try to go for this. You know, there's many aspects that need to be looked at.
I don't think that they are actually taking drugs just because they lost the job or just because they can't pay for student fees. I think the problem actually goes deep inside them. It's like from their past childhood, what they encountered and what they've been carrying, all those baggages, and it starts from there. And then it just builds up. And they're still carrying all these packages when you can just leave them.
That's what I mean by kind of like investing into many of these things. And also what I mean by in terms of not just debt and jobs, what I mean is that if you give people a purpose, if you give people the opportunities to kind of be able to find ways to start off, not only just start off being able to, you know, to do more things with themselves, but also have the opportunity that later on they can still try to do that. It helps,
Understand themselves. The thing is that they can write what they feel, or if they can sing what they feel, mm-hmm. and putting it into some artwork, and then empowering others who have maybe are undergoing the same situation.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, I mean, like I said, I think it's multifaceted. It's not just one thing. It's a cultural, you know, perspective that has to be changed. If you don't do it in that way, then nothing good's going to come of it. You need to have those things, those changes available. That's just how it has to, I think, how it's going to have to be.
And we as citizens, we try our hardest to fit in from a really young age. Maybe not fitting in is a better idea.
I do like that. I think, like I said, it's again, multifaceted. Schools, you know, it's finding ways to, you know, again, teach kids, kind of, you know, be able to empower them. Is also finding ways of kind of, again, offering the opportunities for people. You know, if you make it clear that just because somebody isn't necessarily going to be a doctor, but hey, guess what? There's other opportunities, other career opportunities. There's other options that are here. I'm not going to say socialist kind of idea. I'm not going to say it like that, but I'm just saying, if you find a way to kind of find some aspect of being able to level the playing field to where people can feel like, in terms of prevention, find ways that they can in some way kind of still be able to have good lives, have a good job, be able to have a family, you know, be able to meet, you know, people, you know, being able to make sure that have good health care, you know, something that, you know, regardless of whatever treatments are, it's good health care. That'll help if you educate, if you offer, again, good, you know, if you offer good mental health, you know, services, if you offer those kind of things, I think that is, you know, the right way to go. If you offer the correct treatments, you need, you know, it's multifaceted. It goes from all aspects.
What about alcohol? Can we stop them from taking alcohol?
In terms of the U.S., I don't believe. I think.
Can we replace it with some other nutritious drink? If that were possible.
It's Ovaltine. Don't drink booze, drink Ovaltine. I mean, that's a nice thought. I don't know. We tried it once before. I mean, again, this is a different time, a different period. I think the one thing that the U.S. may have learned, one of the good lessons that the U.S. has learned, was that when they tried prohibition, and I think what they found is, as you're going to find with almost anything, any other vice, anything else, it's not going to go away. It creates a more profitable market. The problem is, and I think this is why legalization is sometimes better, is that when you make it illegal, then you have darker things to kind of move in. You know, in terms of prohibition, you had gangsters move in, you had moonshiners move in, you had people who made alcohol that was really wood alcohol and that killed people. You know, you had things like that. It didn't stop it. It just drove it underground. If you're going to do that, it's going to have to be a cultural change. And I think that will take a very long time in general, just because, as with many societies, whether you look at like the Europe, wherever you look, drinking is part of the society. It's part of something that we do. You know, it's not, you know, for example, if you're in the U.S., I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but if you're in the U.S. and you tell somebody that you don't drink, they ask why. If you tell someone that in the U.S. or anywhere else that you don't drink a cup of coffee, that you don't drink coffee, they don't say why. If you say I don't use mayonnaise, they don't say why. They don't question it. For in our society, alcohol is built in so much into the fabric of our nation that it's part of it. So it's something that would have to, I think, be very slow, and it would be something that would not just happen where you could just kind of say, you know, hey, here's this wonderful nutritious shake, come on and drink it, guys. Yes, it makes me feel great, you know, and it's kind of like, there you go, and everyone's on board. You know, it's going to take time.
Yeah. You have to kind of monitor their tolerance as well.
I just think in general, it's just kind of been proven that, you know, it's something that if you're really going to change the view of something, you're going to need to change it culturally. You're going to need to change it how it's viewed in that manner. if you're going to, you know, if you're going to do that. You know, if you're going to look in any, it has to be, it has to start there. If you do it legally, you're going to get a whole bunch of backlash in one form or another, or it's going to get driven underground. It's just, it's not going to be an easy kind of battle to do. It's something that, you know, regardless of how devastating alcoholism is, and alcohol next to tobacco is like one of like the biggest leading, you know, causes of death.
Yes. Especially for your organs. Yeah. And so I was wondering, like, what if people go through a tolerance test and they know after how many drinks they lose it, and after how many drinks on, and which the specific drink as well, and the volume of the product, they know all these, so they prevent themselves from getting drunk. Would that help?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, they've done a lot of different, you know, there's been a lot of different things that, that people have, you know, have tried in order, you know, to the idea of tolerance and all that. I mean, how can I put this? I think the idea of abstinence or control is a very kind of tough and delicate issue to kind of, you know, kind of really be able to deem, you know, in terms of, like a lot of recovery stuff is they kind of deem it as either you're an addict or you're not, and you have one, and, you know, and once you have one, you can't stop. Many instances, that's true. There are some people that have been problem drinkers, and to one varying form or another, they've been able to find a way to deal with it, or they've been able to find a way to curb it, or they've, you know, found that instead of I smoke a joint, I'll be fine. You know, so I don't know if that's, if that would necessarily be an answer either. I think it's,
yeah, I want them to find their own talents, something, something that would be better and kind of feed off the negative feelings that they were feeling. If they found out their talents, they have something to be proud of themselves.
Yeah.
I think that that would be a positive phase for them.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I do agree. I think that, I mean, it's like I said, from my experience, it's not always an easy thing to kind of, you know, to kind of be able to do. It's there, you know, in terms of if you want to look at it as it being a disease, it's there, it's present. To a degree, it's almost better if you're abstinent, you know, and because if you know you're a problem drinker, the kind of the idea of entertaining it, you know, can also be an issue. But at the same time, there are many people who are out there who will say, I don't drink anymore, I smoke weed. And that's what they do. And whether it's detrimental to them or not, it could be argued. But depending, some people, you know, for some people, I hate to say this, for some people, they may have come to the conclusion that for them that they have to have something, and it may be something of a lesser evil. You know, if you want to look at some people who are recovering, they smoke. Smoking's better than getting drunk and beating my kids. So even though smoking is detrimental to my health,
maybe if I want to stay sober, punching a bag at home.
Exactly. But the idea kind of being is that to a degree, in some cases, for people who are really in bad shape, it's the idea of this is a lesser evil. This is not going to cause you to turn into a monster. You're not going to necessarily rob and steal because you haven't had your morning cigarette, you know, or you haven't had your morning cup of coffee. You haven't had your bag of dope. You haven't had your drink, or you've had too much and there's a problem. But if you haven't had, you know, you're going to be grouchy, yeah, but you're not necessarily going to be, it's not, again, the consequences aren't going to be as high. I think, I think in terms of how we see drugs and alcohol and addiction is kind of, at times, it's kind of like, we'll accept the lesser of the two evils. And so if this is not going to cause daddy to be mean, then let daddy do that. He may get cancer, but let daddy do that, or let mommy go ahead and do this, because compared to what she was doing before, it's not as bad, and she's trying to get better.
Maybe they can learn to find another hobby after that. It's like,
that's, yeah, it's
like a stepping stone.
Yeah, basically, yeah, it's like the idea, like a stepping stone. It's
and you can't stop at one stage. You just have to keep moving.
Yeah, exactly. So it's 100%.
So how concentrated is hard drug used among active criminals?
How concentrated?
Yes.
That varies. You know, it's in terms of the U.S., it varies. It depends. The biggest problem that has kind of come along is that is that, like, now, like with heroin and things like that, and with a lot of other drugs now too, fentanyl has been laced into it. With the idea of the regulation, you know, of drugs, it, you know, it really depends. Like, you know, there have been times where you've had higher potency of cocaine on the street. And then at the time, if there was a drought or there was a shortage, the drug wasn't at, was stepped on more, kind of like cut, and it wasn't as powerful. You know, it's really hard to say. In terms of marijuana, because that's becoming much more legalized now, you're finding a lot more potency to it. Before, it, I think it was like maybe 10-15% THC for the most part. And since it's really kind of become industrialized, overall in places where, which is a lot of places where it's more legal, where it's, you know, it, the potency, the THC potency is much higher. So that's a little bit more of kind of like a, I guess a level, but in terms of like a lot of other harder drugs, it really depends. You know, it's just kind of like, it depends on where it's coming from, who's getting it, what they're doing. You know, it's high potency, but again, wherever you buy it from, who knows? You know, that's, to a degree, that's part of the gamble.
So is there any evidence that holistic practices are working with these patients or criminal patients?
That, I mean, I think yes and no. I mean, that's something I honestly, in all honesty, I really have to look into, you know, the holistic aspect of it. From being married to somebody who's been in the field, I haven't heard of like a lot of like raving, you know, like kind of like I haven't heard people raving about the idea of, you know, Reiki, you know, solving all the solving the problems, and hey, you know, you're addicted to heroin, come and get Reiki, or, you know, or something like that, or, you know, here's some acupuncture, you know, it'll solve all, you know, it's been said, but it hasn't been something that has been kind of like put out there and kind of like pushed as being like the way to kind of do it. There's been some success. I
but
think
it depends on the person, right?
I think it depends on the person. It depends on the insurance, because a lot of times, you know, it's, you know, if you're going to treatment, a lot of times the other thing to also understand is that bare bone minimum facilities a lot of times don't offer those things. A lot of times bare bone minimum facilities just offer like, okay, here's methadone, go, there you go, here's some therapy, sit in therapy, there you go. Sometimes it's the more higher up facilities that offer these ideas of like, here's horseback riding on the beach, you know, here's Reiki, you know, here's you know, here's acupuncture, here's, you know, a whole bunch of other, you know, kind of like holistic treatments that we offer. I think if you really kind of like wanted to get that, you probably would, in all my opinion, have to make it more available, have it more, you know, make it more available to everyone. I'm not saying that it isn't, but I think if you're going to include it, you know, it's going to have to be something that is kind of taught to doctors as well. It's kind of being like, here's also one more avenue to kind of do, you know, so it's kind of like, here, you can provide, you know, you can provide, you know, a drug to help prevent or, you know, withdrawal. But at the same time, here's this treatment that you can also offer as well to kind of help to ease the discomfort and, you know, or to kind of help. That hasn't really, in my perception, really been done.
Yes. And it depends on the willingness of the person to change. If they don't take the responsibility, then there's no use for the holistic practices to work.
Exactly. Yep.
So what reduces the drug market violence?
What reduces it? Yeah. The one thing that one thing that you could say reduces it is, I guess more decriminalization. I think the reality is, I think that when you make it harder to get, when you make it more, when you make it, you know, the more illegal you make it, the more interesting, more desirable to some degree it is. And I think that in some cases, the more that a criminal element will kind of get, you know, become involved. I think it's about the treatment. You know, I think it's about, again, you know, focusing and looking at the addict, offering them ways out that are going to make sense, that are something that's going to benefit them, something that, you know, that will help them. I mean, in terms of dealing with violent crime, yes, I think you need to have penalties, but I think in terms of, you know, in terms of dealing with the idea of drug, you know, crime, the violence associated with it, I mean, I get that is a kind of a hard one to really say. I think the best way to kind of really have it answered is to really, I think, kind of take away the value of it in terms of a black market, in terms of something that can be, that somebody can make money off of. If you can turn that around and turn that into something that, you know, it's not as going to be as desirable to do, then people aren't going to be out there doing it. They're going to try to find something else.
Yeah, it's a challenging problem in Mexico, isn't it?
I believe, yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, I think in many places where it's kind of been produced, you know, or it's a challenging kind of situation. You know, how do you deal with it? I think depending on where you are, I also think it's political too. And I think that comes kind of, you know, kind of plays in part to it as well. I think it's kind of something that kind of stretches out its tentacles into other areas. So I think it's something that, again, it's more dealing with corruption, but also, as I stated, I think that when you cut down on the idea of making it so that way it's something that's illicit and something that, you know, somebody has to, you know, go run off and seek somebody special to buy it from, that's hidden. You leave it to people who are just going to do things, you know, more for profit. If you have something that has some regulations, has some form of something that is going to, you know, watch over it, you know, make sure that the potency is correct, is not going to be too heavy, you know, watches the prices, you know, a man, you know, watches over it, it could be done. That being said, the opioid epidemic proved that that wasn't the case. You know, the opioid epidemic proved that a substance that was regulated, you know, if a company was greedy enough, they could go and they could change everything. And they, you know, and it was proven that, you know, companies like Purdue Pharma knew that people were addicted, knew that people were, you know, were becoming addicts, and because it was making them so much money, they didn't care. So it's a hard kind of thing to do. I think the best way to describe it, last thing, is that each drug is different. And how each drug, and depending on how each drug affects the body, depends on how you're going to regulate it. So again, nicotine, caffeine, even alcohol, to certain degrees, have different effects and have different levels of addiction, how they affect the body, as opposed to something like cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin. And so I think in order to really deem what you're going to do, you need to look at each one that's separately to decide how you deal with it.
That's great. And what about a stimulant for abuse? What do you do for abuse?
What do you mean? What do you mean?
A stimulant for abuse.
I mean, in terms of like methamphetamine, something like that. Like, are you talking in terms of like price, in terms of like, what do you mean, like regulation?
Yeah.
Like,
what do they use for a stimulant for abuse?
There's many in terms of the US. You have like methamphetamine, you have cocaine, you have, you know, crack cocaine, you know, you have, let me see, it's a whole plethora. MDMA, which is basically a form of a methamphetamine. It has a little bit of a different chemical you know, formula. So it affects you a little bit differently, but it still is amphetamine. You have people who use prescription amphetamine, you know, stimulants, you know, Ritalin, Adderall, which is like basically, you know, it's basically an amphetamine. There's many that are out there. You know, cocaine, again, of course, is big for a while. Methamphetamines was. In terms of, you know, it's just the market is big. You know, the market is big. And in terms of, you know, looking at each thing, it depends on what it's, you know, what is needed, you know, where it's applied. You know, so I think it's, but cocaine is a big one. I know that cocaine in terms of Europe has become bigger. At first, it wasn't nearly as big. I know that now it's a much larger kind of portion of the drug market. It really, you know, has become cocaine, methamphetamine, but also it goes by region. Some areas, you know, you'll find it, you won't. But it's all several different kinds. Sorry, I rambled there for a second.
That's fine. And we are now towards the end of the show. So can you sum it all up?
Okay.
What's the best advice you would give to others?
What advice would I give to others?
Yeah.
Okay. If you're talking about in terms of advice, a couple of things. I think one, you have to look at the addict as not being something that's shameful. Or I should say, look at addiction as not being something that's shameful. There's a lot of different kinds of addictions. There's addictions like gambling, sex that don't have anything to do with substances. It is one form or another a disease. It's something that afflicts people. It's something that, you know, for some people it's more obvious than others, but it's there. The shaming of it is not going to change anything. We need proper treatment. We need proper, you know, facilities. We need better healthcare to deal with mental health issues and all that. In order to deal with that, we have to change the view that we see of drugs and alcohol, how we see them, how we view them. I think to a degree that's been changing depending on where you live and what you look at. And I think we need to really take and invest the idea in mental health and really kind of the idea of other treatments to help to deal with addiction. We need to realize that, that mental health is one of the keys in order to really kind of deal with this. You know, jail is not going to be the thing, you know, that's going to handle an issue such as this. It's something that
we had to develop sort of strategies in order to implement human motivation, some self-regulation, some education as well.
The only other thing I will say is, at least in my perspective in terms of the U.S., is that you do need to take a look at the history. You have to also, I think, need to understand where it comes from, where the problems are resolved in. It's in our history. It's in this. It's still playing out in terms of how we view and deal with addiction in general. If you're going to need to do that, you have to also have to, I think, to a degree, be involved politically. But you need to, I think, again, to change the perspective of how you look at addiction. And we need to find other ways of dealing with, we need to find treatment. If you're going to deal with it correctly, find treatment.
Thank you, Lou Ford. It's a pleasure having you on Teo Podcast, The Pandemic Press.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Hey, guys. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Next week, we have another episode on somebody's life journey. It's so interesting. He faced many obstacles, and he even tells how he avoided it and all the kind of mysterious things that happened in his life. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. And don't forget to subscribe to Teo Podcast, The Pandemic Press. We are available on any device. Also, recommend this podcast to your friends. You can take any notes if you get it. Like, I'm giving you so much of information, and with this information, you can kind of solve all of your problems, some of your problems at least, through this podcast. I am your host, Rashti Hevavasam, and I am signing out.